From the Sky News Centre at 6, the UK is set to get a new Prime Minister in a matter of months after Theresa May outlined her exit from Downing Street. Kit Bradshaw reports.
I will shortly leave the job that it has been the honour of my life to hold.
After months of pressure, Mrs May fought back tears outside Number 10.
To serve the country I love.
She's going to quit as Conservative leader in 2 weeks' time, but stay on as PM while the party picks a replacement. Possible contenders have praised her.
Prime Minister's put her heart and soul into trying to do the best for this country.
Her predecessor says he knows what it's like.
It's extremely difficult and painful to step outside Downing Street and to say those things.
Labour wants whoever takes over to call an election.
There has to be another opportunity for the people of this country to decide who they want to be in their government.
Boris Johnson is the current bookies' favourite to succeed Theresa May. European leaders say they're focused on an orderly Brexit.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump's just given his reaction to Theresa May's departure to reporters at the White House.
I feel badly for Theresa. I like her very much. She's a good woman. She worked very hard. She's very strong. She decided to do something that some people were surprised at, some people weren't. It's for the good of her country. But I like her very much. In fact, I'll be seeing her in 2 weeks.
In other news, police in Sheffield say two boys have died and four other children are in hospital following a tragic scene of events this morning. A man and a woman have been arrested on suspicion of murder. At least eight people have been hurt in an explosion in the French city of Lyon. Reports say a parcel bomb went off near a bakery store. No one's thought to be seriously injured. Criminal barristers in England and Wales are being balloted over taking strike action in a row over pay. They could walk out for 24 hours on the 1st of July, potentially causing chaos at magistrates and Crown courts. The Crown Prosecution Service says it's disappointed. That's the latest. I'm David Marsland.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. He's one of the four South West candidates for the Brexit Party, Anne Tarr, and leader of the Lib Dem group in Bristol, councillor for Noel Gary Hopkins. Also, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and former Sunday Times ritualist journalist Kevin Cahill are here too. After the 7 o'clock news, hiding wealth from the tax man, tiptoed around by the Sunday Times. It's become the dark art of the 21st century, wealth hiding, and hiding land ownership too, paying lawyers to threaten publishers, keeping their true wealth off the headlines. And out of the public eye, we hear Kevin's alternative top 10 of wealthy British aristocrats, as not published in the Sunday Times. Also, Northern Ireland, some members of the British Armed Forces could be facing fresh prosecutions, and they're not happy. Plus, the Nicaraguan ambassador to Britain, Giselle Morales Echavarri, was in Bristol this week as part of sporting links between the two countries. We hear about Nicaragua's tense relationship with the United States from her. And Bristol explorer John Cabot, hero or chancer and criminal on the run? From Justice in Venice, and we hear about the Cabot family's role in one of America's darkest and most powerful secret societies. Finally, in an exclusive interview with New York historian Stephen Kinzer, Operation Sunrise and how the Dulles brothers in the US got the Cold War going before World War II had even finished. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast news at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, clear and dry. This weekend, around 18 Celsius and quite warm. Sunny on Saturday, but cloudy on Sunday. Next week, cooling a little to 14 or 15 Celsius, sunny periods, but rain possible maybe Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and a little breezy. Next weekend, that's into June, the 1st, 2nd and 3rd of June, nice long weekend, a bank holiday, around 18 to 20 Celsius, a few clouds, mostly sunny and light winds. That was a Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is one of four southwest candidates for the Brexit Party, Anne Tarr. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Lovely to be here.
First of all, can you just tell us a bit about your background? What's your, you know, how did you come, what were you doing before you stood in this election?
Sure. The first thing is there are actually six candidates for the Brexit Party in the South West.
Okay?
I just happen to be number four on the list. So, yes, I live in Portishead. I grew up in Bristol and I've been working in financial services for the past 30 years. I applied to be a candidate when I saw an advert and it said, click here if you want to be a candidate for MEP elections, and I did it. And I was absolutely surprised to be selected. But here I am 4 weeks later and it's been an exciting 4 weeks.
Well, I bet. Why do you think that what you've been doing in the past would make you a good representative politician for us?
Well, I think if you look at the people we have standing for us, you have there people who've done deals for a living, both in the UK and overseas. And what's sadly been missing in the deal negotiations so far with the EU are people who have practical experience of how to make a deal, how to leverage what we have and what the EU wants, and come up with a practical solution to some of the problems we have. Looking at some of Theresa May's negotiating positions, it seems to be, well, tell me what you want and I'll give it to you plus more. And that's not how you do a deal.
Well, what do you make of the Prime Minister's... Well, it's not quite her resignation today, is it? She's going to resign in 2 weeks' time. So, always, she seems to be kicking the can down the road. And it would be nice to get the whole leadership process going, but I imagine that the Conservative Party doesn't want that to be happening during the summer recess or whatever. But anyway, what do you make of her final announcement that she's going today?
Well, I think you have to look back to how she was appointed and to see how David Cameron had the bright idea of having the referendum, which I think he felt pressured into doing. We had the referendum, and then when the result wasn't what he wanted, he decided to resign and left the Conservative Party then deal with the mess. And the Conservative Party, for their own reasons, Theresa May was crowned, as opposed to having to fight for the crown.
Yeah, this is something people quite often forget, isn't it?
That
Andrea Leadsom, over a weekend, decided, oh, I'm not going to stand against her.
Yeah.
So there was no real leadership election. Certainly the dwindling numbers of the Tory party, which I think is now around about 100,000 members, ordinary members of the party, didn't get a chance to vote.
No, and I think that's caused a lot of upset in the Tory rank and file. And it also shows a great danger when you do have coronations and when you don't have a proper full campaign. However, Theresa May has been the Prime Minister for the last 3 years. The message I get from people I speak to is that they recognise the fact that she's done the best she can, but she's just simply not been the right person that we need as a country at the time we've had. And it's not personal, but as a Prime Minister, I don't think she's been particularly effective.
One of the things that occurs to me is that she made a big thing about compromise in her resignation speech, where we'll hear a very shortened version, my super edited version of her speech in a minute. But it's like she approached this as, well, here's one position, which is the extreme Brexiteer position. Here is the European position. I'm going to find a middle ground. And that's what she's absolutely stuck to. And you've got to admire her for that, surely.
Well, I just wonder if she'd been as stubborn with the EU as she was with her own MPs, whether we might have a more pragmatic solution now. She's shown extreme stubbornness with trying to bring her deal back four times to Parliament, with no recognition of the fact that the MPs, her MPs, and the public at large simply don't like it. And if she'd actually shown a bit more bottle when dealing with the EU, I think we'd be in a different position today.
Okay, before we hear my little shortened Theresa May resignation speech, if you could please tell us, when are the Brexit Party going to actually find some policies? Because it seems to me the only policy they've got, or you've got, at the moment, is just to leave the European Union as soon as possible. Surely, for any politician, that's not good enough just to have that as the only policy. What about things like, for example, this week we've seen the collapse of British Steel, which is, you know, one of the most important industries and a massive employer, 5,000 people potentially now losing their jobs. Do you not have a policy? policy about British Steel?
Well, I think that's a great question. In fact, it's more than 5,000, isn't it? Because it's all the add-on jobs as well. So you're probably looking at 20, 25, 30. Who knows how many are actually going to be directly implicated in this? And I think that's the crucial element. You've hit the nail on the head there. Because what we're looking to do is to bring decision-making power back to Westminster. And so at that point, we can then make the decisions as a nation or as a government can make the decisions as to what industries we want to support or not support at times like this and look at this strategically as to what's right for the nation. Now, there's almost this, I always feel at the moment we're in a situation where our government has actually forgotten how to govern and has forgotten how to actually decide what its priorities are and go and make sure the policy reflects those priorities. We've become so used to just taking the rules from the EU and then implementing those rules, we've forgotten the ability we have to actually set our own strategy. So in terms of our policies, our number one policy is to get ourselves out of the EU, preferably with a free trade deal. But if you go into any negotiation, you have to be prepared to walk away from the table. Otherwise, what is the incentive of the other party to take you seriously and not just fob you off with the worst deal possible, which is what we have at the moment?
Well, you've sidestepped the question, haven't you? What would you do if you were in charge at the moment with British Steel? Would you be bailing them out to save those jobs, or would you be applying the free market principle and letting them collapse?
Well, that's you're making it sound like it's a very simple answer, and it's not. It's more complex than that. Because if you look at the problems with British Steel, one of the problems has been that the imports that we're receiving into the country from places like China and India, where they can make steel a lot cheaper than we can in this country, because they have lower environmental standards and lower labour costs. You have to remember, too, that the German steel industry is in crisis at the moment. Their major manufacturer is up for sale. So it's not as simple as saying, should we bail them out or shouldn't we? We have to look at what's right.
But what would you say
us.
If you had a direct access to those people about to lose their jobs? What would you be telling them? This is the Brexit Party position on this. Assuming that you succeed in becoming a member of the European Parliament in the next few weeks, surely they're entitled to know what your views are about their future.
I would like our government to have the ability to actually influence that.
No, but
to actually
make
that
decision. What would you
do?
Do
you know what? I'm not going to answer that question because I've only been doing this, as I said at the beginning. I think it's unfair to push me on this particular question at this moment in time. I would say that it's not always, in my experience, not always a good idea to rescue a failing industry. You have to look at why it's failing and then work out whether it's not in our strategic interest to save that plant or not.
Well, one of the reasons it's failing is because they have to pay a vast amount of money to the EU, to Brussels, and there's a legal obligation for them to do that. But again, I'm going to just kick Theresa May down the road a little bit longer, because since we're talking about British Steel, I'll just ask our other guest, Gary Hopkins, what do you make of this week? Is it really an important event, the collapse of this company this week?
Yeah, it's extremely important, and one of the reasons, and I stress not the only reason, but one of the reasons, is Brexit. Basically, their trading position has been made a lot more difficult because of the uncertainty in where we actually are, investment into that is that much more difficult, because clearly if we do complete Brexit, then they will be in an even more difficult position with regard to trading across Europe. So it's one of the factors. It's not the only factor, but it is a factor. And I'm afraid that, again, that applies to several other industries that are in difficulty at the moment. Car industry. Now, you can't say everything is down because of the Brexit situation, but a fair amount of it actually is an influence. And when you're making a business decision, you look at a whole list of factors as to what the future is likely to be. And it's why that the parent company for British Steel have actually just invested a large amount of money into a French steel maker. Why was that? At the same time, the British one is being cut off from funds, and it's because they've got a market.
Martin Summers, what do you make of this? The collapse of British Steel this week? Anne's quite right. Actually, most of the analysts are saying there's going to be at least 25,000 jobs lost.
Well, in the longer term, the deindustrialisation of the country through 30 years of neoliberal policies is coming home to roost. In a sense, Brexit is neither here nor there. You know, the world economy is on a knife edge because of the collapse of the banking system in 2008. There's a glut in steel markets. That's not the only thing that's a glut. There's a glut in. There's a massive asset bubbles created by quantitative easing. And of course, what Brexit has been, from my point of view, is a massive diversion from discussing the real problems facing the global economy and Britain's.
But I mean, isn't it the case that Britain just hasn't had an industrial policy since it's been pretty much in the common market? We've left a lot of this to a much wider market, and if the Germans can make steel more cheaply and more efficiently, British steel is going to go.
In Britain, we've decided not to have an industrial policy since 1979. That's been policy, not to have a policy. It was a stupid policy. It was silly. A lot of the early years of the Thatcher era got rid of it, got rid of most of our industries. And of course, once you've got rid of them, you don't get them back.
Okay.
So now we're stuck where we're stuck.
Kevin and the Spectator is saying that the BBC is being a little bit naughty in saying it's a Brexit-related problem because they're not making clear how it's Brexit-related. The final trigger, they say, for British Steel's collapse into administration was not low steel prices, but a demand from the EU for £120 million payments under its emission trading scheme, the ETS, which is supposed to provide an incentive for heavy polluters to cut carbon emissions. Now, the Cabinet Office had a look at this and they said, well, yes, this is a legal obligation. They have to pay it and we're not going to pay it for them.
Yeah, but the problem is, and this is where the Brexit, Anna's party's solution isn't a solution. Even if we leave the EU, we'll still have to pay the carbon charge if we want to trade with the EU. And there'll be similar problems everywhere. The theory that we can, you know, cut off and zip out doesn't work. They're our nearest neighbour. If we want to trade with the EU, we have to pay whatever they charge.
And I see you shaking your head there, Anne.
Can we just, one tiny
thing? Yeah, go on.
Channel 4 last night pointed the finger at the financiers who actually really bankrupted British Steel. Greybull, this funny little outfit in West London, who were taking about $22 million a year out of the company, whatever they put into it, which is not clear if they're really...
I mean, if this £120 million had been paid, surely this is a viable business.
No, well, you're picking up on small things. The financial company that he mentioned bought it for 1p.
For a pound.
Yeah, for a pound, yeah. And then, of course, what they've done is they've asset stripped it. They've asset stripped it, which is always what happens in Britain. It doesn't happen in Germany because they've got different takeover rules.
Anyway, Anne, you were nodding or shaking your head.
I was just going to say, I mean, one of the reasons why it needed to raise the money to pay the bill is the fact that the British Steel sold some of its permits to raise some working capital. And I don't know what they did with that. I'm hearing allegations that there may have been asset stripping. But the fact was that they made a decision to sell their carbon emissions, which is one of the things you can do under the EU.
Yeah,
you can trade them. And so then they found they actually needed these permits back and they didn't have the money to pay for them. So you have to question the actual underlying management of this company. And obviously, you know, Greybull Capital, I think, was involved with Monarch Air Collapse as well. Which
Prince Charles
million.
Was one of the architects of this carbon trading system, and apparently he makes money out of every bit of carbon that's traded, allegedly. I mean, that was a story we covered tail end of last year. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Theresa May. And this is my super edited version of her. Well, it's not quite a resignation speech, is it? Maybe we I'll just ask you, Kevin. Is it known for prime ministers not to actually resign, but to say, I'm going to resign at some point in the future?
Not usually. And British parliamentary history hasn't actually seen anything quite like this ever.
Ever since I first stepped through the door behind me as Prime Minister, I have striven to make the United Kingdom a country that works not just for a privileged few, but for everyone, and to honour the result of the EU referendum. But it is now clear to me that it is in the best interests of the country for a new Prime Minister to lead that effort. So I am today announcing that I will resign as leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party on Friday the 7th of June, so that a successor can be chosen. I've agreed with the party chairman and with the chairman of the 1922 committee that the process for electing a new leader should begin in the following week. I have kept Her Majesty the Queen fully informed of my intentions, and I will continue to serve as her Prime Minister until the process has concluded. I will shortly leave the job that it has been the honour of my life to hold. The second female Prime Minister, but certainly not the last. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
Well, some emotion, definitely a bit of emotion in the end of there. But we haven't actually seen lots of emotion from Theresa May over the last few years, Gary, have we? Do you think this is about time she went, or are you sad to see her go?
Well, I mean, she was handed an impossible job to do. All sorts of promises had been made. There was lack of definition of what Brexit actually meant. And you've got two groups within the Conservative Party who actually had completely different interpretations of what Brexit actually meant. They were never going to get together. Then she made it worse by actually trying to get the Conservative Party to agree to push her deal through, which was never going to work.
But it all could have been saved, surely. If, you know, the time last year, July, I think it was, the Chequers agreement, when Boris Johnson and David Davis resigned, they said, look, this backstop is just not going to work.
Well,
and they said, well, it's not... And she, surely, at that point, she could have compromised and said, OK, well, the backstop's not going to be...
It was already too late by then. She set the pattern right at the beginning when she's decided it was going to be a Tory Brexit. She felt that that was going to be good for her party and that they could deliver it. They couldn't deliver it because they couldn't agree amongst themselves. At that point, when she took over, right at the beginning, it should have been a cross-party. It was a cross-party referendum result. I sincerely regret it actually happened the way that it did, but it was cross-party, and implementing the result of that, whatever that might actually be, should have been a cross-party endeavour. But it wasn't. And that's where she got herself from a very difficult position into an impossible one.
So there's also apparently now from the Treasury more money being put into preparations for a no deal, and that was raised at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Darren Barks.
Speaker, it took time to get there, but the Prime Minister has now recognised that a no deal Brexit is not a viable option. But she knows, as well as the rest of us, that many of her potential successors do not feel the same way. So can she tell us whether she agrees with her Brexit Secretary, amongst others, who thinks that we should be spending the coming months stepping up preparations for a no-deal Brexit, or with her Chancellor, who has issued an edict that no more Treasury money should be spent on preparing for a no-deal Brexit?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
As the older lady knows, there is only one way of this House ensuring that we leave the European Union without no-deal, and that is to leave with a deal, and that is to support the second reading of the withdrawal agreement bill and take that process through this House. But the Honourable Lady, I'm sure, also knows that the legal default position continues to be no deal. Were we to get to the 31st of October situation, I want us to leave the EU before then, but were we to get to the 31st of October position, it would be a matter for the 27, not just for this country, to determine whether there was no deal or not, and that is why it is absolutely right that the government is continuing to make preparations for no deal.
So, Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dems here in Bristol, is it prudent to be preparing for a no deal now?
We don't know what's going to happen, genuinely.
So should we be preparing for it? I mean, you know, surely if you don't know what's going to happen, you've got to prepare for different eventualities.
Well,
and it's taking a long time this now, isn't it?
How much do you pay for an insurance premium? You've got to assess the risk. And basically at the moment, it's very difficult to assess what's going to happen. We know that previously Cameron got frightened into having the referendum by UKIP, as the fan club was called then. But basically he made a very, very severe mistake then, and landed his party and the country in one heck of a mess, which we've never recovered from. Now, I don't know how things are going to pan out in the future, but certainly if, let's say, Boris Johnson gets in, or somebody with similar views to him is in charge of the Conservative Party, he'll hear Brexit Party, he'll try to copy as closely as he can what they actually want, but he'll never get it through the Commons. And so basically, should we actually be spending a lot
of money
on it?
As the Prime Minister there said, the legal default is that we would then on Halloween leave with no deal.
Yeah, how appropriate. But, I mean...
Anyway, can I just ask Kevin?
The House of Commons can stop it if it wants to.
Kevin, could you just address this whole business of is it prudent to be preparing for a no deal now?
Yeah, well, it's obviously prudent given the uncertainty. But what about Yvette Cooper's motion that prohibits, by law, a no deal Brexit? There has to be a deal. And that's why Gary's point, it's not going to go through the House of Commons.
But surely the EU withdrawal, doesn't the EU withdrawal bill also say if you can't agree anything, you get a no deal? Martin, what do you think it makes sense to prepare for a no deal now?
Well, as has been said, because of the situation being as it is, the various positions are being taken. I think the point is that you can't get no deal through this existing parliament. And ultimately, what the Labour Party have called for today, which has been calling for all along, is a general election.
Yeah, well, that's pie in the sky, isn't it?
It's not pie in the sky. It's only because of the Permanent Parliament Act that was passed by the Lib Dem coalition with the Tories.
Yes, but that's the law. It's the law.
But in the past in Britain, we would have had a general election ages ago.
It's not the past, it's now.
If there's a different arithmetic in Parliament, then you've got a different game.
I'm just trying to figure out this whole thing of preparing for a no deal. Is it now the time to do it? Because that's what Theresa May seem to be suggesting there. So anyway, Anne, from the Brexit Party, what do you think?
Well, I think maybe we're looking at this through the wrong end of the telescope. For example, is it a question of us deciding when we're going to leave, or have we actually told the EU we're leaving and the EU are just letting us stay in until the 31st of October? So there were comments from Monsieur Macron the other day where he said, why would we carry on letting you stay in? We want you to go on the 31st of October.
But they wanted us to go on the 29th of March, didn't they?
Yes.
So, well, I mean, surely, you know, these deadlines have to actually mean something. Otherwise, why is anyone actually using these dates?
Well, my understanding is that the default position at the moment with the EU is that there is strong pressure within the EU not to extend that deadline. There's also a question under the parliamentary rules as to whether or not a new prime minister could actually let us leave on a WTO terms without actually taking that back to the House of Commons or not. I'm not an expert on legislation in the House of Commons. My understanding is that is actually a possibility, because the government is obviously in charge of the business of the day, and if they don't put it forward for a vote, then they can't be voted on.
What about this poll, Anne, in the Sunday Express last weekend, which was giving 63%? I mean, I was quite staggered that it wasn't really much more reported, because it's quite a large amount of people. Nearly two-thirds favour a no deal if Theresa May's bill doesn't pass. And obviously now she's given up with it, so it's not going to pass. So that's the default position now, is that according to this Comres poll, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. According to that poll, two-thirds of the British public want to leave with no deal. Now, that is even more of a majority for Brexit than there was during the referendum.
Yeah, I think I haven't seen that particular poll, and I haven't read the background to it. But what I would say, from having done the campaigning over the past month, I think it's fair to say that the British public just want us to get on with it. And it was very interesting. In North Somerset, we had local elections just last month, and the view of the local elections was, if we don't vote, then we can't complain about our councillors. So the opinion yesterday was very much, why are we even having these EU elections? We voted to leave. We should have left already. And I think those high views in that poll were saying, we want to get out. Let's just get out, and then we can get on with something other than just talking about Brexit all the time.
Gary, the headline on the Sunday Express was, Brexit bombshell, Nigel Farage should lead Brexit talks with no deal still on the table, says today's poll. Nigel Farage is the best place to restore Britain's self-confidence and should lead the Brexit negotiations with the EU, a Sunday Express poll has revealed.
Right, well, he runs a fan club, not a political party.
It is a political party. It's got no policy.
There's no members. You can't get membership even of the Brexit Party.
Well, what's he a fan of?
Well, he's a fan of himself. That's the biggest problem. And he's tried five times to even get into Parliament and failed every time. Well, the thought that somebody like that should lead negotiations
to be fair to Farage, there was a prosecution, a of the Conservative Party for large overspending on the area where he was standing in the last general election,
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway, Kevin and Martin, do you want to do a duo on this? You first, Kevin. What about this poll? 63% apparently want a no deal. That's what the Sunday Express Conrad's poll says.
The Express, both Daily and Sunday, has been extremely dubious in its headlines.
Well, that's what everybody says, isn't it? Yeah. That doesn't agree with the position.
If you actually read, I've obviously followed them. And it's very difficult to know how reliable they are.
Okay, well, let's just assume that this Conres poll is a fair poll. Yeah, it may not be, but if it is, that's quite a large number of people, isn't it? 63%.
I want to go back to something because it puts Anne on the spot in a sense. What the Brexit poll revealed was that the country is divided, and you don't reunite the country by backing one side or the other. You have to build a bridge. And Theresa May failed to do that.
Well, she tried.
No, she didn't. No. All of you have been far too kind. She set out with red lines, which she discussed with nobody. And the common sense position is you've got a large part of Britain who want to stay and a larger, very slightly larger part who want to go. Your problem is the combination. The problem isn't backing one and delivering it for one. That's a catastrophe in the making.
Kevin, I was listening to Radio 4 earlier with various people saying that actually the real person to talk to if you wanted to find out what Theresa May was doing was her husband, Philip May. He was the one that was taking all the phone calls. And, of course, he's a massive financial investor. What do you think? Do you think it's feasible that his role has been quite a lot bigger than we've been led to believe?
Well, one of the problems was getting Philip to go on the record to anybody.
So he was quite happy to pick up the phone off the record,
It was very different. Theresa May is a loner, which people took a long time to realise. She hasn't got any close friends or pals. She just thinks it up in her own head. And she did. It was a strategic error class A. You've got a divided country. You do not resolve the problem by backing one party.
Anyway, so do you want to just answer Kevin's point there?
Yeah, I think the fundamental issue here is the fact that what we're seeing over the last 3 years is a complete lack of vision from our political leaders. And this is why the country, I think, is so divided and so anxious. And what I feel is some of the anger we're seeing on with both the Leavers and the Remainers is that they are anxious and they are concerned because all we're hearing on both sides is project fear. And it's a project fear of leaving, it's a project fear of staying, what's right, what's not. And it's just making the whole situation far, far worse. If you want to do something big, if you want something groundbreaking, you need somebody who's got the charisma to actually say, this is going to be great, this is going to be wonderful, we can do it. And instead we just had, well, we'll make it as least bad as we can. That seemed to me to be coming out of Theresa May the whole time. It could be, this is our least bad option. And that doesn't actually help you when you're trying to do something so major. If I can just say something else, I actually think one of Theresa May's biggest failing was that she got into the detail. It was not her role as Prime Minister to get into the detail. She should have had committees, she should have had the experts actually looking at the detail and coming up with possible solutions to it and building a strong negotiating position, and she failed to do that.
Those claims you're reading out there about where people are on whether they want to leave or not, the only way to test that is to ask them. There needs to be three options in a referendum now. Do you want a no deal leave? Do you want a negotiated leave, as Mrs. May had, or do you want to stay? And those three options should be given to the people.
Well, they don't need to be given to the people. We've had a poll; they've been asked, and it's a Conres poll. because there's obviously amongst the Remainers in the room, there's a lot of scepticism about this poll. I'll just let the listeners decide by putting a link up to it.
Yeah, and there's been large numbers of polls showing most people want a referendum as well.
So on this point of having a second referendum, that also came up at Prime Minister's questions this week. The question is, should we have a second referendum before we allow a no deal to take place?
Dr. Philip Lee!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If polling is to be believed, the winning party in tomorrow's Euro elections will be the Brexit Party. This party, in contrast to the Vote Leave campaign in 2016, has clearly stated that no deal Brexit is its policy. on the basis of normal turnout, that means that between 6 and 7 million people will have voted for no deal, which begs the question, what of the other 10 million Brexit voters in 2016? It concerns me and has long concerned me that we don't have the consent here in this House to deliver the Brexit that is likely to emanate from this House. With that in mind, and I congratulate the Prime Minister on the first steps yesterday towards acknowledging this, can she commit towards working, reaching out across this House in order to bring about the vote which remains to take place, which is the choice between having a final say of the British public or a no-deal Brexit?
Prime Minister!
I say to my honourable friend that I don't recognise actually the choice that he has set out, and for this reason. First of all, as I said earlier, I have not changed my view on a second referendum. I've been clear that I believe this House should be delivering on the result of the first referendum. And the choice that is before this House, I believe, is that whether or not it wants to deliver on the result of the first referendum and deliver on the manifestos on which the majority of members of this House stood, which were clear that we wanted to do that with a deal. We can do that. We can do that by giving second reading to the withdrawal agreement bill and seeing that bill through this House, seeing that bill get royal assent, ratify the treaty and leave the European Union.
Martin, do you think we're going to have another referendum before there's a no deal?
Well, it's possible. I mean, you can't say that you can't rule it out. I think the other thing about the poll you were mentioning earlier, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens on Sunday when we get the results from the European elections, because it could very well be that Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales will vote for Remain and England will vote for Stay, and that looks like Yugoslavia in 1991.
No, it's not going to be civil war, is it? Martin, whenever there's an election, there are some parts that vote Tory and some votes that vote Labour, and there's not a civil war over it. Could you just give us your view on this, Gary Hopkins, Lib Dem, to see whether we're going to have another vote, a no deal?
I think another
vote before a no deal can take place.
Before any final arrangement and deal can happen, because the party that's likely to finish top of the polls is the Brexit Party, but that still will be about a third of the electorate. So does a third of the electorate decide what happens? The Labour and Tory parties are vaguely somewhere in the middle in terms of, you know, some kind of softer or harder Brexit somewhere there. And other parties which have actually done best in this election in terms of growth have been ones that have actually said, we don't want a Brexit at all. We need to put those three options, and we know clearly what those three options are now, on the table for the public to say, this is what we want.
And another referendum before we decide on a no deal?
I think this goes to the heart of democracy. To have a democracy, you have to accept the result of the election, and the losers have to acknowledge the fact that they lost. We had the referendum in 2016. It followed David Cameron negotiating a new deal with the EU, which didn't go particularly well, but he did his best, I believe. He went and tried to negotiate a new deal with the EU. He then put that to the British public. He said in the leaflet, which we all received through our letterboxes at vast cost, that the EU may not give us a trade deal. And so that was perfectly clear. Despite that, despite all Project Fear, despite all the threats, the plague of locusts and everything else that was going to hit us, the British people decided to vote to leave, which came as a big surprise, I think, to most of us. We then had the general election in 2017. 80% of the population voted, or the electorate voted, for the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, both of whom stood on the pledge to honour the results of the referendum. The Liberal Democrat vote collapsed, and they've got, 11 MPs? So I think it's perfectly clear that we have to honour the results of that referendum before we can have another referendum. And I would just like to say this point. I think that these elections are obviously taking place at the moment with the Euro elections. We need to see what the results of those are. But if we leave on WTO terms and then 5 years down the line, people want another referendum, see whether we should rejoin the EU, that's absolutely fine. I think that's fair if people want to do it at that point. What we can't have is another referendum before we've actually implemented the results of the first referendum. That is not democratic.
Okay, well, Well, that's Brexit, hopefully, done. I'm sure someone else will bring it up again. But I think we're going to talk about some of the other problems afflicting the country. I'd like this whole Brexit thing to be finished with. I think most of other people would too.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Well, we had the United Nations condemning Britain this week, and although in a way this is an international story, I'd just like to sound out our guests on this one, starting with you, Kevin Carhill. They're saying apparently Britain is one of the worst human rights abusing countries in the world. I'm not sure that is the basic standards right across the world, Britain is the worst, but it's getting worse faster than many other, well, almost any other country.
Well, I mean, let me throw this one to Anne because it's about the practical reality of government. Look at the Home Office's record. The Home Office have got absolutely everything wrong, and it's going to cost us $1.5 billion in compo. Now, they got watership, the West, the
Windrush,
the Windrush wrong. They got a situation in which 97% of students taking an exam were characterised as criminals. There's a few other. One of the directors tried this. Nobody, this hasn't been anywhere. The Home Office has a board of directors. Most people have never heard this, but they have. And one of the guys on the board has made the decision to bet $1 billion against the pound.
Okay, no, so this is profiteering. Well, yes, but this is off the point, really, because they're talking really about benefits and the fact that so many people now are having to go to food banks, that sort of thing. Martin Summers.
I mean, obviously, this is a report by a part of the UN, and it's critical of the austerity policies that have been pursued in Britain over the last few years. And broadly, of course, I agree with that. But of course, we're not claiming that we've turned into Cambodia under Pol Pot. You know, it's still Britain, but it's there's been an awful lot.
They're saying this is preventable, basically.
Well, of course it is. I mean, in actual fact, the austerity policy is all wrong. We shouldn't have cut public expenditure when the banks crashed. We should have nationalised the banks and increased public expenditure and raised taxes up to the level they were in the 1950s, 95% as a top rate of
tax. I'm actually going to give you a special buy on this, Martin, because there's another question at Prime Minister's Questions, which is about Lloyds Bank and about fraud still going on. Of course, one of the reasons that I've brought this up this week is because we've been covering over the last few weeks allegations of £1 billion fraud going on at Lloyds Bank in Bristol here. And so the bankers, I think, make explanation for some of the problems that they've been causing that have led to austerity.
Kevin Ollenray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. When Sally Masterton discovered a £1 billion fraud at Lloyds, the bank sought to discredit her to the regulator, constructively dismissed her, and prevented her working with a police investigation who had described her role as vital. 5 years later, the bank apologised and paid an undisclosed amount of compensation, yet the FCA continue to refuse to investigate. Would the Prime Minister use her powers to compel them to do so and sanction those responsible, including, if relevant, the Chief Executive for those 5 years, Antonio Horta Osorio?
I say to my honourable friend, I think obviously it's important to remember that the events at HBOS Reading Branch constituted criminal activity, and it's right that those responsible were brought to justice. The FCA are currently conducting two investigations into the events at HBOS Reading, including the bank's communications with regulators following the discovery of the misconduct, and Lloyds have appointed a former High Court judge, Dame Linda Dobbs, to consider whether issues related to HBOS Reading were properly investigated and reported by Lloyds Banking Group. Those findings will be shared with the FCA, and I look forward to the conclusion of all those investigations.
Well, this is a tip of the iceberg stuff. It's years later, and what should have happened, as Peter Galbraith, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the US economist, has pointed out from the US, you've got to bust loads and loads of bankers, you've got to send them all to prison, you've got to seize their assets, and that's what should have happened. But instead, and when for example, after the referendum, Mark Carney did a big dollop of quantitative easing to keep the asset bubble going, and that's why we didn't have a crash after the referendum. There will be.
This is about FCA, really, about regulation of.
Well, yes, but the regulation.
One of the problems with the Financial Conduct Authority is they're actually funded by the institutions they're supposed to be regulating.
Well, that's right. The whole thing has become a self-reinforcing circle.
Why aren't they funded by, say, the Treasury? You know, well, that seems to be the obvious people to do it.
Well, because why is a financial asset company that strips assets being put in charge of British Steel? That's the British way of doing things. And of course, years ago, you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country without permission from the government until 1979. That was normal practice all over the world. And I remember my interviews at Oxford when I was a teenager, and they said, what do you understand by the term siege economy? Because that's what we were talking about at that stage. Nobody can take their money out of the country. We may end up with a no-deal Brexit, Corbyn as Prime Minister, and we're going to have a siege economy.
That siege economy might be caused by all these billionaires trying to flee. I thought that was quite a fantastic and fascinating story this week in the Daily Telegraph. Anne, Britain's billionaires are preparing to flee the country amongst fears that Jeremy Corbyn will be the next Prime Minister.
Can I just go back a step? I'm sorry to go back, okay. But I have actually got experience, because I've obviously been in financial services for many years, so I have got some experience of the FCA. And I know that I came across fraud that was going on and misleading information being given by one of our competitors. And we reported it as a firm to the FCA, who basically were not interested whatsoever in investigating it, which I found particularly shocking. If I go back even
longer...
Can you
just talk about the extent of it? Because they might have said, well, it's maybe not very much.
No, it was quite substantial.
Give us an idea, ballpark figure.
I can't remember. It was substantial. People were basically taking out loans on their houses in order to invest that money into assets, which they were told were 100% secure, and they weren't. But that was what they were told. And then people ended up losing their houses and more. And they were, instead of having a rich... a comfortable retirement, they were ending up having to rent properties and rely on state aid. And it was absolutely shocking. And we had concrete evidence of this, and the FCA weren't interested.
OK, so when the FCA weren't interested, did you go to the press with it?
We tried, but it's quite... it's difficult to always do that, simply because... The press don't always understand the intricacies of it, so we did what we could. But our job as a regulated firm at that time was to go to the FCA, which we did. But if I go back 30 years, I was involved in, it wasn't me personally, but one of the people I know was involved with mortgage fraud, which he uncovered, and he ended up being prosecuted for discovering the mortgage fraud. And until I left the company I was with, I was forbidden from giving evidence in that case by my employer. And so there is this sort of thing. I don't want to make sound like all conspiracy theories, but this does actually go on, and that steps do need to be taken. But I would just go back to some of my earlier point that we were talking here about some of these human rights issues and everything, and that is that in this country, I think we've forgotten how to govern ourselves. We've become rule takers instead of rule makers, and that's what needs to change. And that needs to be a sea change throughout big businesses as well as through government.
With regards to, because I'm a retired independent financial advisor as well, and I observe the regulators, and basically, if it was systematic, it was too big for them, and they looked the other way. So equity release, and what happened around about that was largely ignored. If individuals made sometimes quite small mistakes, they were jumped on from the greatest height. And actually, one of the reasons why we had a potential financial collapse, which the country had to retrieve from...
It's called the bailout.
Well, yes, but before you get to the bailout, you've got to get yourself into a mess in the first place. And what was actually happening in this country is that financial arrangements were allowed by the Brown government, which even the US actually stopped happening, some of the technical systems, and they were cheered on by the Tories. And basically, it was a collapse waiting to happen because of the risks that were being taken. Completely unacceptable risks.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because HSBC were not prosecuted in Britain, they were prosecuted in the US, weren't they? And then what happened? The chair of HSBC's risk committee went on to become the chairman of the BBC. In fact, they were rewarded in Britain, whereas actually, Kevin, they were actually getting a hard time in the US.
Yeah, well, the US uses its rules to tax British banks. However, British banks have misbehaved as badly as everybody here has said. I worked for a bank years ago, and it had three balance sheets.
Okay, which what were they
with the Bank of England?
Okay, so what were the three balance sheets for? One was for the official submission, and the other one was the
The first was for Companies House. The second was for the Bank of England, and the third one was private.
And that was the real one, was it?
That was the real one.
Okay, the only real one was never allowed to be known. Okay. Sounds like the Merchant Venturers, because you're not allowed to know what they're up to, are you, on there with their up in Clifton with their I think, is it a Royal Charter? And you have to go through the Privy Council in order to get any kind of sight of their accounts. Goodness knows how much they've got. Anyway, we'll come to John Cabot and the Merchant Ventures in the second half of the show. But anyway, let's get back to brass tacks in the real world and our schools.
The enemy home is drought in two ways, Mr. Speaker. One is a Labour government would properly fund our schools. We wouldn't shortchange our children. We wouldn't use Orwellian words like fair funding while we're cutting. Yeah. Per pupil funding, Mr. Speaker, just so the Prime Minister understands it, has fallen by 8%. For sixth forms, it's 24%. At the end of last year, the Prime Minister said, austerity is over. Maria, who describes herself as a teacher in an underfunded school, wrote to me this week. And she asked this. Maria is a teacher in an underfunded school. I think you need to listen to her. Yeah. When will the government stop making false claims of increased funding for schools and start to tackle the serious problems faced by teachers? When will the cuts end for our children's schools?
Prime Minister!
I repeat what I said. We are giving every area more money for every pupil in every school. But let's just see the situation that this government inherited and that we would see under a Labour government in the future. Having to spend more on debt interest than on our school's budget. That's not because of what this government is doing, because we're bringing debt down. It's the legacy left by a Labour government. More money on debt than on our schools.
More money on debt. That's a bit strange. I thought the zero interest rates were around. But anyway, look, let's go straight to Anne from the Brexit Party on this, because what he's saying there is a pretty cheap trick, Jeremy Corbyn. He's saying that's what the Conservatives are playing here, that they're saying, yes, there's more money going on schools, and they're failing to mention that actually it's less per pupil. In most schools, around about 8%. In sixth form colleges, less than 24% down per pupil.
Yeah, well, I'm chair of governors of a primary school in North Somerset, and the funding is a real challenge. And I think what I would say to this is that if we don't have to spend $39 billion to the EU under the withdrawal agreement, we'll have more money to spend on things such as our schools.
Just tell us about what's going on at your school. Give us an idea of just what sort of decisions you're having to make.
Well, decisions we're having to make is just... Can we actually afford to invest in teacher training? Do we have the money for that? Or do we spend... Or how do we actually...
Surely it's not the jobs school to train teachers, is it?
No. But you have ongoing continuous professional development. So if you have a teacher who's been in a job for 10, 15 years and you want to go and train them and make sure they're up to speed with all the latest things, how do you actually get that? How do you actually fund for that? I was asked by North Somerset the other week if I would go on a governance training course. Well, no, it's a governance evening, which a chair of governance should go on. And they wanted to charge me £50 for the privilege for them to tell me whether or not I was doing my job right as a volunteer, which I thought was a bit rich given the fact that we have very little money. And the problem you have in some areas is that if it's done by per pupil, if you're in areas where you maybe have an ageing population, you don't have many children in the school, how do you actually make sure that you are actually able to cope? But all the schools, I would say, primary schools that we know about, are really struggling to actually make ends meet and give and they're working really, really hard to actually make sure that the children get the education they should get.
Martin Summers, you're working in schools too. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's standard knowledge by people working in schools that there are enough resources, and of course, especially special needs, which is what I do, a lot of that funding comes through the local authorities, and of course, we've had Bristol City Council taken to court by the Lib Dems to make sure that they do what they're supposed to do, but of course, that then leaves the council millions of pounds down potentially on other things. And of course, this whole idea of austerity is wrong. It's just wrong. We shouldn't have been doing austerity at all. There should have been a completely different policy. And of course, if the Labour Party had had the bottle to take on the City of London years ago, we wouldn't be in this mess. That's why Brian Gould went back to New Zealand back in the 1980s, because he said, you lot aren't serious. And of course, they never were serious.
It's a good question, isn't it, Gary? Is austerity wrong? Is it just completely the wrong idea?
Well, I mean, let's not forget that austerity, as you know, in inverted commas, started in 2008 under a Labour government, and then for several years it actually did manage without causing huge.
I mean, is it right or wrong?
For several years, it did manage to reduce the financial mess that we were actually in without having huge results, negative results. What's happened since is that the Tories have gone absolutely berserk. I mean, when people look back at the previous government, they think, Christ, things weren't as bad as we thought. It's all gone wrong since we left government. That's where the country's gone to pieces. And with regard to funding for schools, basically, it is tight, but for God's sake, I'm very glad we've got pupil premium, because at least now the children who are most in need do have a little bit fairer share of the money than they had previously. And with regard to the special needs in Bristol, the council acted illegally, which is what the High Court said, and my belief is they're still doing it. Watch this space, there'll be more stuff coming out.
Martin, you were shaking your head there as Gary was talking about austerity.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fundamental questions about what economic policy to pursue have been basically narrowed down to a very narrow. The idea that
you were saying austerity started in 2008 under Labour.
Well, yes, it did, because they instead of nationalising the banks, they said we're not nationalising them. We're giving them loads of money and let them carry on doing what they were doing anyway.
They didn't just give them the money; they lent them. So effectively, they became the major.
Yeah, shareholders. Indeed. In other words, at that point, you've actually got to move to a different way of organising the economy. Capitalism basically is going down the drain. It's not going to exist in 5 or 10 years.
So, did capitalism actually die in 2008?
Listen, the real problem we've got to face is that it may be that capitalism is going to die, but we haven't actually got an alternative to it. And that's the real problem. And that's the sort of thing we should have been talking about. And instead, we've been talking about Brexit.
So why hasn't the Labour Party been talking about that then?
Well, the Labour Party, there's been a huge fight inside the Labour Party to get rid of what we regard as dead wood that were running things for years. And we've tried to sort that out.
Labour Party have been too busy scrapping.
Well, inevitably, because because of the first past the post system, parties tend to be big coalitions, yeah, and that's inevitable. I'm in favour of proportional representation. Of course, the UKIP party got 4 million votes, didn't it? And nobody elected. No, I know, but I mean the point is that you're going to do well in this Brexit election because it's a PR election. Whereas if it was a first past the post, if we come to a first past the post general election and Brexit party stands against the Tories, then they're going to cancel each other out, which of course is going to help us. But of course, the electoral system's rubbish.
And the Lib Dems. I think Gary's waving there. The Lib Dems.
I must just say, though, that you can't. The Brexit Party has got people from the left and the right. We have people who are. And it's a broad church of people coming together for the common aim of delivering the referendum result for democracy. And the one thing I would just say, from my own economics background, is if you raise taxes, you reduce the actual revenue.
Well, that's the Laffer curve, what I used to call the laughable Laffer curve when I taught A-levels, because, of course, it's just a random distribution curve drawn on a graph. In actual fact, all the evidence shows that the high rates of tax in the 1950s, 95 and 96% in America and Britain, that allowed us to build a national health service and win the Battle of the Injim River against the Red Army in Korea, and we could afford it all. And that's because the wealthy paid their... After World War II, the wealthy were made to pay their way.
It is important, this story we were talking about earlier, about these billionaires, isn't it, Anne, deciding that they might want to just disappear because they don't want to be taxed. And we're going to be hearing in the second hour from Kevin about how good our aristocrats and our super rich have become at hiding their wealth.
I need to answer that. OK, you can't take action on things like tax... climate change or other strategies unilaterally. It needs to be multilaterally, because we're a multilateral world now.
In the EU, maybe. Anyway, thanks to our guest in the first for one of six South West candidates for the Brexit Party, Anne Tarr, and leader of the Lib Dem group in Bristol, Councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7.
Live from the Sky News Centre.